Authorities believe Pearson randomly targeted Davis while seeking a librarian who had disciplined him. Meanwhile, in Chicago, Illinois, at least three people were killed and 15 wounded in a series of shootings this weekend, including one that killed an 18-year-old. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
KBOO Community Radio and the North Portland Neighborhood Library is proud to sponsor the Jefferson High School 13th Annual Multicultural Film Festival. On January 14th, the documentary The House I Live In explores the risks that prohibition poses to freedom and the tragedy of addicts being treated as criminals. Meanwhile, the prisons of America are growing overcrowded with nonviolent criminals and illegal drugs are still being sold in schoolyards. This film is being shown on January 14th at the North Portland Neighborhood Library off of Killingsworth Street at 6 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
What we're going to do is throw a lot of banana peels around Chicago and have the machine stumble.
I had a dream that the only reason the employers were so powerful was that we were weak.
There's this myth that black people did not resist until Watts or until the Black Panther Party. It's just not true.
Tune in, turn on, and remember is a monthly special program on the history of KBOO Community Radio, commemorating KBOO's 45th anniversary year. The last installment of this special series will be on December 24th at 6 p.m. And listen online to the full series at kboo.fm/tune-in-turn-on.
This is Ramona Africa, and you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your dial. KBOO is the exact example of the community taking charge of itself. On the move.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a federal judge in Portland announces the date of a fairness hearing to hear community input on a Portland police settlement.
Washington, D.C. increases their minimum wage, and Milwaukee looks ready to follow suit.
And in Thailand, ruling party members sneak past protesters to register for upcoming elections. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 23rd, 2013. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Frances Fagan. In Washington State, the online health insurance exchange was offline last night until early this morning. The outage came at a crucial time for the Washington Health Exchange as the deadline approaches for residents to sign up for health insurance. A spokesperson for the Washington system called Health Plan Finder told the Associated Press that the site was down for scheduled maintenance overnight. Washington Health Exchange spokesperson Michael McCard told the AP that their software fixes should allow more people to complete their enrollments. People starting their application through the website by midnight tonight will have extra time to complete it and receive health insurance coverage starting January 1st. Washington Health Exchange officials extended the application deadline to help more people sign up.
A Utah judge refused a request by state officials today to stop same-sex marriages. It was the third time Utah officials have asked Justice Robert J. Shelby to stay his ruling since the original decision in the case. More than 200 same-sex couples have applied for marriage licenses since Shelby's decision last week. Judge Shelby overturned Utah's ban on same-sex marriage Friday, ruling the voter-approved measure is a violation of gay couples' constitutional rights. Lawyers for the state say they plan to ask a higher court to put gay marriage on hold. Mormon church representatives have continued to oppose same-sex marriage, publicly stating their support on what they call traditional marriage. Utah is now the 18th state where same-sex couples can legally marry, joining Washington, California, New York, among others. The Mormon church is one of the leading forces behind California's short-lived ban on same-sex marriage, known as Proposition 8, which voters approved in 2008. The church said Friday that it stands by its support for, quote, traditional marriage, and hopes for a higher court to validate its belief that marriage is between a man and a woman.
The office of the Oregon Secretary of State has made almost $90,000 from selling the personal information of Oregon voters over the past 5 years. This information includes names, addresses, phone numbers, birth dates, and voter histories. The cost of accessing this content makes it expensive for individuals to get information, but records show that for-profit companies have paid the $500 fee. This information fee is higher than the fee of $7 in Washington and $30 in California. Organizations that buy this personal information are not supposed to use it for commercial purposes, but as a Secretary of State spokesman has stated, Oregon state law does not define just what is meant by commercial purposes.
Two former Multnomah County employees allege their managers discriminated against Black and Latino workers and later retaliated against them for filing complaints. Sylvia Gomez and Daryl Winchester filed suit last Thursday in Multnomah County Court, claiming they were passed up for job promotions, subjected to hostility, and disciplined, when white colleagues in turn received no discipline for the same actions. Documents filed in the suit say that the county leadership discriminated and retaliated against plaintiffs after complaining about race discrimination and a racially hostile work environment. The plaintiffs are seeking $600,000 each for emotional distress and suffering, plus thousands of dollars in lost wages and benefits. The suit also alleges that Gomez was passed up for a promised promotion and then suspended without pay for 4 weeks before being removed from her leadership position. Winchester was reassigned multiple times after the written complaint to management, was given an unusually high workload, and was then suspended from work for failing to follow protocols that his white counterparts also failed to follow without recourse, according to the lawsuit. In November of this year, the lawsuit says Winchester was forced to retire early because of the alleged discrimination.
A federal judge has set the date for the fairness hearing that will allow community input on proposed policy changes in the Portland Police Department. The hearing will take place on February 18th at the federal courthouse in Portland. Members of the community will be able to testify about a proposed settlement between the Portland Police, and the U.S. Department of Justice that came out of an investigation of the police department last year. According to that investigation, Portland police engage in excessive force when dealing with people qualified as mentally handicapped. The February 18th hearing will determine whether the out-of-court settlement negotiated between the Justice Department and the Portland Police is, quote, fair, adequate, and reasonable, end quote. Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch and Shauna Curfee of the National Lawyers Guild spoke recently on KABU about the problems with this settlement.
What's disappointing is that the DOJ made a findings letter before the settlement agreement was ever entered into, and the findings letter described Portland police oversight system, the accountability system in our city, as Byzantine, ineffective, and so we were really looking for some real change to this oversight system, and it's been very disappointing that that's not what's happening now.
I was going to say, and in 2010, the city called together a stakeholder committee that made 41 recommendations, and about three of them had been put in place, and about two more of them will be put in place if the vote goes through on Wednesday, but that leaves 36 more floating out there. And we made this very clear to city council. We had people who sat on that stakeholder committee come to them in October and say, we have other stuff that needs to be done, and so far that message is falling on deaf ears. The auditor has not added anything to that proposal. And as I said, in fact, she's taken some things away. The Community Oversight Advisory Board is not intended to be a police accountability board in the same sense that our Independent Police Review Division is. What it is supposed to be doing is overseeing the implementation of this agreement with the DOJ. And that board can't be chosen until after the compliance officer is hired, and the compliance officer probably won't get hired until the agreement gets put into the court. And so the agreement is going to be put in the court this coming Thursday, the 19th. And then the ball will start rolling on these other issues. So the COAB will not have very much power at all. All they're going to be doing is saying, we think that the police are following, the city is following this agreement or not. And then they present that information back to the public and to the DOJ, and hopefully somebody will listen and start doing what they're supposed to do, and the compliance officer will listen and do what they're supposed to be doing.
I would say that the police union has made police accountability in the city of Portland very, very difficult. And I'm not derogating people's labor rights. I certainly am pro-labor, but I think this union is exceptionally strong and that they are very reticent to change anything that would lead to more public involvement in police accountability. Even in settling their differences over the settlement agreement and the DOJ suit, they've reserved the right to grieve provisions in that settlement agreement that relate to officer questioning and officer oversight. So I think the police union is basically what's made this very difficult, and the city has not been willing to really take that on. The most important negotiations took place behind closed doors, so we don't know what trades happen as a practical matter during negotiations. What we do know is there is a discipline matrix in place now that was not in place before, and there are going to be annual performance reviews. Unfortunately, those annual performance reviews are not tied to discipline in any way. In
right.
other words,
why are they done?
That yeah. was the question we had for the city. So yep. the city's response is...
That was Dan Handelman of Portland's Cop Watch and Shauna Kerfee of the National Lawyers Guild speaking recently on KABU about the proposed settlement between Portland Police and the Department of Justice. The fairness hearing has been set for February 18th, and anyone in the community can testify.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin may soon become the next municipality to increase their minimum wage. An ordinance currently under debate would increase the minimum wage for companies doing business with the county from $7.25 to $12.45 per hour. The change would also impact businesses that get subsidies from the county in the form of rate reductions for loans or below market value sales of land. The Milwaukee County Comptroller has voiced concerns that the effort will cost taxpayers millions of dollars and possibly even bankrupt the county's family care program. Jeanette Wick-Limbs, a research professor from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, explained the objective behind the policy, saying that doing business with the county should mean providing jobs that in turn provide a family with a wage and merely places them above the poverty line. Lim recently released a report to access how the living wage ordinance might impact the county. She anticipates the effect at less than 0.1% of the county's budget for associated costs with this living wage ordinance, should it go into effect. Washington, D.C. and other nearby counties recently raised their minimum wage despite pressure from giant retailer Walmart. A larger trend may be in the offing as more than a dozen states begin to raise the minimum wage floor to start the new year next week.
In Washington, D.C., the minimum wage is expected to reach $11.50 at the start of 2016. Additionally, Montgomery and St. George's counties in Maryland, which adjoin Washington, D.C., are also raising their minimum wage to $11.50. The Living Wage Advocates in D.C., Working Families, announced last week that they plan to put forward an initiative for the November 2014 ballot, which would increase the minimum wage further to $12.50. 21 states have raised their minimum wage in recent years. Maryland's Montgomery and Prince George's counties also raised their minimum wage to $11.50 an hour.
Despite adopting a public position which discourages companies from using sweatshop labor, the United States government continues to spend over $1 billion annually doing exactly that. Oversight on these factories is a challenge due to layers of contractors hired by the agencies who don't generally place orders directly from the plants. Officials with the Labor Department claim they abide by a zero-tolerance policy for using overseas plants that violate local laws. But suppliers to the American government from counties such as Bangladesh, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, and Vietnam show a pattern of violations. Examples of the harsh work conditions auditors found include padlock fire exits, buildings at risk of collapse, falsified wage records, and repeated injuries from sewing needles when workers were rushed to meet quota.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for a live interview with Paul Rowland from Umatilla, Oregon, at a Canadian tar sands megalod protest. That is followed by Labor Radio at 6 and Prison Pipeline at 6:30. Tonight's show will focus on the 211 Info Service for Oregon and Southwest Washington, which helps people find resources to meet basic needs, including food, housing, and economic opportunities. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is forecast to have a high temperature of 46 degrees, with heavy fog in areas and almost no chance of precipitation. Tonight should see steady rain decreasing to light showers with a low temperature of 37 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are as follows. 32 counts per minute in North Portland with a high of 57. In Raleigh Hills, it's 29 CPM with a high of 49. Powell Butte measures 29 CPM with a high of 44. Medford readings are 36 CPM with a high of 56. Vancouver, British Columbia has a 30 CPM with highs of 57. And Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 34 counts per minute with spikes up to 51. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
The time is 5:17. We go now to Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
Ah, 'tis the season for family, friends, eggnog, chipmunks singing Christmas carols, and all out no mercy blow 'em all to hell war. Not war like in Afghanistan. No, no, this is the far right's god-awful war on the war on Christmas. In this season of peace on earth, these delusional hucksters are fomenting hatred of, well, of whom? Blasphemous, liberal, democrat, atheist, humanists, they shout. Those heathens who actually go around saying happy holidays rather than Merry Christmas, as Jesus taught us to say. Or was it Constantine the Great in the 4th century who came up with that? Never mind. The rightist point is that diabolical lefties, i.e. Marxists, are out to ban Christmas entirely. No less of a heroic defender of the faith than Sarah Palin has even written a thin book about this devious plot, revealing that Happy Holidays is merely, quote, the tip of the spear in a larger battle to make true religious freedom a thing of America's past. Luckily, note the Merry Christmas Crusaders, such bright lights as Governor Rick Perry of Texas are pushing state laws to bypass the silly U.S. Constitution and allow Christian icons and ceremonies into our schools. A creche in every public space is their cry, a cross on every city hall. To hell with Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, the winter solstice, etc. This is war. This is Jim Hightower saying, no, this is hokum, hoodoo, camel dung. It's also insulting that they would attempt to create a fictional piece of religious discrimination, whine that they are a repressed minority, and equate it with war. First, Jews, Muslims, and others don't get to brand public spaces as their religious property. Second, about three-fourths of Americans are Christians, so drop the martyr pose. And third, war really is hell, with blood, lifelong trauma, and death. So stop pretending you're in one.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at LaborRadio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Congressional passage of the federal budget deal delivers lumps of coal into the Christmas stockings of 1.3 million jobless workers across America. Unless Congress acts to extend unemployment benefits, those workers will be cut off December 28th. The Indiana AFL-CIO is joining labor voices nationwide, urging Congress to extend these unemployment benefits. Indiana AFL-CIO spokesman Jeff Harris says that nearly 70,000 Hoosier families will be cut off December 28th, and that's bad not just for them, but for jobs and the economy in general.
We just think this is a travesty that Congress is playing politics with this when they should be doing everything they can to help support these people. The White House Council of Economic Advisors is estimating that about 240,000 jobs are on the line, or in Indiana, just over 3,000 jobs on the line. That, you know, if we eliminate these extended unemployment benefits, the consumer demand will fall. And those jobs could be sacrificed.
Right-wing anti-union organizations, including the American Legislative Exchange Council, are targeting at least three more states for so-called right-to-work campaigns in 2014. They include Oregon, Ohio, and Missouri. The efforts seek to defund trade unions through legislation. 24 states in the U.S. have right-to-work laws on the books. The laws prevent automatic union dues payments in union shops. Without those laws, unions are able to negotiate dues payroll deduction arrangements with employers. Supported by right-wing organizations and some business groups, the laws are aimed at crippling the financial resources of labor unions. Organized labor and allies are preparing to fight these anti-union efforts. Chicago voters will vote in a non-binding ballot referendum in March on whether fast food chains and retailers should pay workers $15 an hour. Community groups working to raise wages for low-paid workers have delivered petitions to the Chicago Board of Elections to let voters weigh in on establishing the city minimum wage. The ballot question will be whether businesses making over $50 million a year in profits should pay the living wage of $15 an hour. Chicago public media workers have voted to join the SAG-AFTRA union. The vote was 40-7 in favor. Included in the new bargaining unit will be the staff at WBEZ Public Radio. Employees at public radio station KPBS in San Diego also recently voted to join SAG-AFTRA. More than 20 TV and radio stations in Chicago are under SAG-AFTRA contracts. The union represents more than 165,000 actors, announcers, broadcast journalists, dancers, DJs, news writers, news editors, program hosts, puppeteers, recording artists, singers, stunt performers, voiceover artists, and other performers nationwide. The International Union of Operating Engineers is formally reaffiliating with North America's building trade unions. Operating Engineers President James T. Callahan says he's pleased to once again be affiliated with the building trades. Building trades President Sean McGarvey called the reaffiliation a great day for the construction industry in America. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
For the latest national and international headlines, we go now to our friends at Feature Story News.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Daniel Renches. The United Nations is preparing to increase the size of its 7,000-strong peacekeeping force in South Sudan. There are concerns that the world's newest country could descend into civil war after a split between the two major groups represented by the president and former vice president. From Washington, Rob Flynn reports.
The United Nations is set to nearly double its peacekeeping force in South Sudan from 6,800 to close to 12,000 to stave off violence as fighting continues between the government and rebel forces. Today, Donald Booth, U.S. Special Envoy in the country, announced that South Sudan President Salva Kiir is prepared to meet with the rebels, led by Riek Machar, amid reports that the former vice president is also willing to find a peaceful solution. Additionally, the U.S. has positioned approximately 150 Marines just outside the country's borders, prepared to enter to protect U.S. interests and nationals should the need arise. Rob Flynn, Washington.
Apple stocks rallied after the company announced a deal to supply its iPhone to China Mobile. The partnership gives Apple much greater access to China's mobile phone market, with an estimated 1.2 billion users. Rachel Silverman has more.
The long-anticipated deal between Apple and China Mobile brings the iPhone to the world's biggest phone company. The iPhone is already available in China through two smaller carriers, but this deal links it with a bigger network and the marketing power of state-owned China Mobile. The iPhone faces tough competition in China from less expensive smartphones running Google's Android software. Forecasts of possible increased iPhone sales as a result of the deal vary widely, from 10 million to 40 million in the coming year. The iPhone will go on sale in Apple and China Mobile stores in mid-January in time for the gift-buying rush that typically comes with the Lunar New Year. Rachel Silverman, San Francisco.
Two members of the Pussy Riot punk rock band have been released from jail in Russia under an amnesty. The artists were sentenced to 2 years in prison, each for performing an anti-Putin punk prayer in one of Moscow's central cathedrals last year. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
Maria Alyoshina was released from the penal colony number 2 in Nizhny Novgorod. The activist said she was not aware of the upcoming release and was taken away from the prison early in the morning secretly in a private car. Her fellow activist Nadezhda Telakonnikova was freed later in the afternoon from a hospital prison in the Krasnoyarsk region. The young woman said the release is, quote, a burden of responsibility, including to those who stayed behind bars. The freed Pussy Riot members plan to work together on a human rights project helping people who are in prison. The case of the performers, who were charged with hooliganism based on religious hatred, fell under the amnesty announced by the Russian authorities to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the Russian Constitution. Daria Bondarchuk, Moscow.
From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN. The inventor of the Kalashnikov assault rifle, Mikhail Kalashnikov, has died at the age of 94. The assault rifle, the AK-47, is one of the world's most widely used firearms. Anya Ardaeva reports from Moscow.
Mikhail Kalashnikov's relatives told Russian state TV that the designer's health has been deteriorating recently. He spent 2 weeks at a cardiology center in May and was flown to Moscow in June for treatment. Mikhail Kalashnikov's assault rifle, which he invented at the age of 20, has become the world's most widely used weapon. He has created several other guns with the common characteristics of simple design, reliability, and ease of maintenance. Mikhail Kalashnikov said repeatedly during his interviews that he invented his guns to allow people to protect themselves and not to attack each other. Even though he was honored by the Russian state, Mikhail Kalashnikov never made a fortune from inventing the most well-known gun. The manufacturing company Izhmash has patented the weapon only in 1997, and by 2006 it accounted for only 10% of the global production of AK guns. Anya Ardaeva, Moscow.
The US has raised eyebrows in Qatar and Yemen by accusing two well-known Islamic fundraisers of funneling millions to al-Qaeda-related jihadists. Priscilla Huff has more from Washington.
Abdelrahman Al-Nuyami is a well-regarded professor at Qatar University who has helped the ruling Al-Thani family with their charitable efforts. Abd al-Wahhab al-Humakani is a Yemeni who has worked on the U.S.-backed National Dialogue Conference, a group working with that country's democratic transition. The U.S. has named both of those men as specially designated global terrorists in order to freeze their assets, suspecting both of them have funneled millions to al-Qaeda-related groups. The U.S. Treasury insists that charitable donations must not be used to support violence. The men deny the allegations. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
And that's the latest feature story news. Daniel Wrenches reporting.
Last week, the U.S. Senate passed the National Defense Authorization Act, or the NDAA, by a vote of 84 to 15. The NDAA is a massive spending bill which sets aside over $500 billion for the national defense. It covers a range of defense issues, including NSA surveillance and the detaining, targeting, and killing of U.S. citizens by the military. Specifically, Section 1040B of the law contains a provision in which the U.S. government can declare a U.S. citizen as an enemy. Such citizens, according to Section 1064, can be targeted and killed by U.S. drones on U.S. soil if these citizens have been determined by undefined means to be, quote, actively engaged in combat against the United States. There is no provision for due process or trial by jury. Oregon Senators Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden both voted against the bill. Senator Merkley voted no because of concerns regarding open-ended U.S. commitment in Afghanistan. Senator Wyden had proposed an amendment to the bill, which would require more disclosure about the National Security Agency's surveillance programs. This amendment was not considered. Other NDAA opponents included Republican Senators Rand Paul and Ted Cruz.
A U.S.-based security firm has denied allegations that it knowingly installed a backdoor for the National Security Agency to access user data. The company RSA sells encryption software that companies and individuals use to protect proprietary information and communication. Bodley encryption technique includes a backdoor for the NSA to be able to read encrypted communication. A report from the Reuters news agency alleges that the company received a $10 million contract from the government agency to allow the cracking of encrypted messages. RSA has denied any secret contract and said, posting on their blog, quote, "We have worked with the NSA both as a vendor and an active member on the security community. We have never kept this relationship a secret and, in fact, have openly publicized it. Our explicit goal has always been to strengthen commercial and government security." One security analyst called the company's blog post the most carefully worded press release of the year. The analyst pointed out that the statement seems to deny knowing at the time of any contract that the random number generator was flawed. But clear details about its weakness have only emerged in the past few months, while the alleged contract would have been undertaken at least 6 years ago.
Over 150,000 protesters have joined together in Bangkok this week in reaction to the upcoming elections on February 2nd. Citizens have been trying to block political representatives from registering with the intention of forcing the resignation of current Prime Minister Jinlak Chinawat, who they feel would win the election if it goes forward. The Chinawat family has broad support among rural and working class voters in Thailand, but the country's elite, mostly located in urban areas like Bangkok, feel that their policies are a threat to the current status quo. Some protesters even claim that Jinlak is merely a puppet for her brother, the deposed Prime Minister Thaksin, who was ousted from office in 2006. Thaksin, a billionaire tycoon, was accused of abusing his power while in office and convicted for related charges in 2008. Some claim he is simply ruling through his sister while in exile. One sentiment shared by many protesters is a desire to return to an absolute monarchy system instead of the current democracy, stating that it should be up to the king to elect government officials. While protesters concede that the current policies benefit agriculture, these policies do not respect the country's king. Those opposed to the protests state that the universal healthcare and transportation advances initiated by the current government have been beneficial to Thailand's future.
And now we go to the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, December 23, 2013. The Israeli army releases a prominent political detainee and troops kidnap 16 civilians during invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Samer Issawi, iconic Palestinian political prisoner and hunger strike organizer, was released today following over 17 months in Shatta Israeli Army prison. Family members said that the Israeli forces raided their home on Monday and prohibited them from organizing any celebrations, local sources reported. He was originally arrested by Israeli forces during the Second Intifada, but was among hundreds of prisoners released in 2011 as part of a bargain for the release of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. He subsequently launched a hunger strike against the renewed detention, ending the strike only after Israel agreed to release him. Samer Issawi's hunger strike was one of the longest ever in history and brought him close to death. Elsewhere, at least 16 civilians from different areas of the West Bank were arrested by Israeli forces on Monday, according to security and local sources. Among the detainees are 5 youth from the town of Anabta near Tulkarim, 8 people from Al-Mazra'a Al-Kibliya near Ramallah, and an unspecified number of people from Beit Ula, located in Hebron Governorate, as well as Beit Rima and Deir Abu Mash'al, located within the Ramallah Governorate, the Palestinian News Network has reported. In other news, Israeli police sources reported that a rocket fired from Hamas-ruled Gaza Strip hit a southern Israeli community early Monday morning without causing damage or injuries. Israeli bomb squad personnel found the rocket fired from the Gaza Strip near the city of Ashkelon, according to police spokesperson Mickey Rosenfield. Police say that the projectile hit near a school bus stop. Gaza government spokeswoman Isra Al-Hamadallah told Palestinian Ma'an News that Hamas had not confirmed or denied their involvement in the incident. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, December 23, 2013 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, two soldiers with the NATO-led international coalition were killed today in separate attacks in Afghanistan. The coalition's International Security Assistance Force said one soldier was killed in southern Afghanistan, while the second died in eastern Afghanistan. In other news from Afghanistan, Radio Australia reports that Afghan asylum seekers are demanding to stay permanently in Belgium. About 200 Afghan asylum seekers and their supporters have assembled in a church in western Belgium, demanding to see Prime Minister Elio Di Rupo and request residency papers. The demonstrators marched over 40 miles from Brussels to the town of Mons to meet with the town's mayor before setting up camp at the church. And Afghan President Hamid Karzai has once again reiterated his preconditions for the signing of the bilateral security agreement between Kabul and Washington. Karzai said that his preconditions for the security deal remain unchanged and insisted that raids on Afghan homes by U.S. forces should be immediately stopped. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Gabriel Adra and Robin Ryan. The producer is Ross Freeman-Levin. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. And the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews.
If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issues you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Frances Fagan. Coming up on Tuesday morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalist Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, on Alternative Radio, social critic and activist Barbara Ehrenreich speaks on kicking people when they're down. At 10, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein.
At 11, on Stage and Studio, a weekly live show featuring best performing, literary, and media arts in Portland and beyond. And 11:30 on Art Focused, host Joseph Gallivan interviews with artist Susan Johnson, who's been exploring the medium of olibar in her paintings. Excuse me, oil bar. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you're not yet a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for a live interview conducted by KBOO reporter and the evening news broadcast, excuse me, producer for this evening, Ross Freeman-Levin. Good night, Francis.
Good night, John.
Thank you. Thank you again for tuning in to the KBOO Evening News. This is Ross Freeman Levin. We haven't been able to reach our reporter on the scene, but we'll have a full report on the protest in Umatilla on the Megalodes on tomorrow morning's, on tomorrow's evening news. Instead, we bring you this report aired earlier about the protests against the Megalodes going to the tar sands.
This is Paul Rowland, and I'm speaking with Chuck Sams, Communication Director of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla. Mr. Sams, could you tell us what, and we're talking, of course, about the Megalode shipment, the current one, which is in Pendleton or outside of Pendleton somewhere, and destined to go through the traditional ceded territories, as I understand it, of the Umatilla. What is the Umatilla's interest, and what are your concerns about this Megalode issue?
Well, our primary concerns consist with the state of Oregon's Department of Transportation. We didn't find out about this Megalode passing through our ceded territories until November 5th, 2013. And we found out not through ODOT, but through the media, a media release that was given out by ODOT. We contacted regional ODOT staff to obtain information and raise our concerns regarding the potential impacts and our interests. We learned that ODOT intended to issue the permit to Omega Morgan for the first of the shipments from the press release, as I said. Then we sent a letter dated November 18th to ODOT's, the head of ODOT, Matt Garrett, indicating the tribe's opposition to the shipment based upon the lack of consultation and consequently uncertainty regarding potential impacts to our lands and our resources. The letter highlighted Executive Order 9630 and Oregon Statute 182.162-168, which directs Oregon state agencies to make a reasonable effort to cooperate with tribes in the development and implementation of programs of the state agency that affects the tribes, so in this case, ODOT. We made sure that our concerns were noted with Matt Garrett, but we'd really only heard back basically from him not too long ago, and they admit that they didn't follow the consultation, but we really didn't see any remediation in that. And because we didn't see any remediation about following through on their consultation obligations, we sent out a letter yesterday to Governor Kitzhaber asking him to follow up with ODOT and for ODOT to follow back up with us regarding the lack of consultation.
And I assume since it was just yesterday, you haven't heard anything back on that.
Well, we've heard back from Matt Garrett, the director of ODOT, this afternoon. Executive Director Dave Tovey of our tribe and Matthew Garrett were able to speak. And there's a clear recognition that they didn't follow through on the consultation. We know that two more loads are coming through. Mr. Garrett is directing ODOT regional staff to sit down with our tribal staff so we can work through these issues and figure out not only what the current load that's going through our territory, what effects it may have, but the plan for two future loads. We're still very disappointed that and concerned that they didn't follow their own consultation procedures before issuing the permit, and we hope that they and are assured that they will go through this process with us as they plan on these other two loads.
Now, are you somewhat surprised about this lack of consultation, given that the Nez Perce tribe not all that long ago went through a very similar thing?
We are. You know, our issues are a little bit different. So the Nez Perce that passed right through their reservation, and it passed through scenic and wild river air corridor, which the tribe had interest in along with the Forest Service. So their situation is a little bit different than ours. This megalode is actually passing through our ceded territories and not through the heart of our reservation. So there are some differences there.
So could you express what the tribe's concerns are specifically about the megalode passing through? And maybe first, I'm sure this has been explained in the past, but talk about the nature of the ceded territories.
Well, the nature of the ceded territory exists is that in 1855, the Confederate tribes, or the Umatilla, the Walla Walla, and the Cayuse people, ceded over 6.4 million acres to the federal government. But even though we ceded over those 6.4 million acres and reserved a 500,000 acres specifically for us in our home reservation, we still have treaty rights on those in those ceded territories. So we still have a right to hunt, fish, gather, collect medicines and traditional foods in those areas. So the federal government, under several acts, and in particular the National Historic Preservation Act, has a responsibility and the sub-governments of the states to consult with the tribes anytime these loads, shipment loads, or potential loads that could cause potential damage to our environment or natural resources they must consult with us first prior to issuing permits or having those things go through our territory, our former territories.
And so then what are your specific concerns about this shipment passing through those territories?
We're breaking into this previously recorded report to go live to our reporter Paul Rowland on the ground at the Umatilla Megalode protest. Paul, are you with me?
Yes, actually I'm at the Wild Horse Casino, the Umatilla Wild Horse Casino in Pendleton, and I'm with Mike Gaskill, organizer with Rising Tide, and with Art McConville, who's a Umatilla tribal member. And I guess I'll just pass it on first to Mike quickly to talk about sort of what's going on right now.
Hello.
Hello, Mike. You're on the air.
Great. Well, what do you want to know first?
Well, first, I'd like to give a quick primer because some of our listeners aren't totally familiar with the protest, so I have a quick intro to read, and then maybe I'll go straight to you for a description of what you're seeing on the ground. But right now, a protest is taking place to challenge the megalode of pipeline equipment on its way to Canada through Oregon. And protesters are questioning the decision of the Oregon Department of Transportation, which issued permits to a Hillsboro-based company to transport these massive pieces of equipment, of oil extraction equipment, across Oregon and the West to Canada. The equipment's on its way, and it will be used there in Alberta to extract tar sands that will then be shipped by pipeline through the United States for export. And protests over the last several weeks have been able to delay the first load of the three planned shipments, with some protesters chaining themselves to equipment and trucks to stop the loads from moving forward. Other delays happen because of weather and conditions. The first megalode did manage to pass out of Oregon and into Idaho, but two more loads have already been permitted for this same trip. And the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla have lodged a formal complaint with the Oregon Department of Transportation that they were not consulted. The tribes were not consulted before the permits were issued. So maybe you can describe the scene on the ground. Is it Mike?
It's Michael. Great. Well, right now, a whole bunch of folks from the Portland area, Olympia, all over Cascadia, if you will, have just gotten here to Pendleton. Actually, we just literally walked into the meeting center here a few minutes ago. So we're all still kind of catching our breath and stretching out and discussing what's going to happen tonight. And I think Art can speak to what's going on tonight a little more, because really what we're here to do is be here in support and solidarity with the Umatilla who are really taking a good portion, some really active members of the Umatilla are taking a really strong stand.
Michael, it sounds like you're there in solidarity with the tribes. Before you hand me off to Art, can you describe sort of the size of the crowd that's gathered there for this protest of the Megalodes Hall?
Sure. And I would just say, we're not looking at tonight as a protest. We're looking at, tonight as a ceremony that we've been invited to participate in. We are not attempting to blockade anything. Here, like right around the solstice, where we are definitely coming together and, as I say, performing a peaceful ceremony and building these, growing these relationships and talking about moving forward with the campaign, because Omega Morgan and the folks who are trying to ship these pieces of extraction equipment are looking for a long-term haul route, and we want to make sure that that's not in the Northwest. So, in terms of what's tonight is going to look like, Art may have more to say on that. But I can definitely say that I and the other folks that came out are really honored to be here tonight and are looking forward to a really peaceful ceremony and demonstration.
Thank you, Michael. Why don't you hand me off to Art, and I'll just remind our listeners while you're passing the phone that you're listening to KBOO FM and we are airing a live report on the ground from Pendleton regarding the Megalodes long haul, which is crossing through tribal lands and through Oregon on its way to the tar sands of Alberta, Canada. And I believe I have Art now on the phone, a tribal member. Is that right, Art?
Yes, yeah, tribal member, Umatilla tribes, yeah.
So, Art, maybe you can tell me about what's taking place right now for you in your tribal lands and where you're at tonight regarding these megalodes.
Well, we've always kind of been against anything regarding the land and the water and all that stuff, any kind of potential or even feasible damage, you know, or any impact on our land and resources. So, but we have a lot of people here that are, you know, really educated in that kind of field. But the role that some of us are playing here is the spiritual role of it, and we're bringing our prayers, our songs, our ceremony to the event, to the site. And the last one is here in Pendleton. We went over there every night and we sing songs and pray. And you know, they didn't really want us there, but they kind of pushed us way up to the edge, but they didn't bother us much. But I understand down in John Day area, they was arresting anybody in sight down there. So.
How many people are gathered with you from your tribal constituency there, and how many people have joined you in solidarity from outside groups from the other regions around the Northwest?
There's probably about... but maybe 15 of us from the tribes here, but then there's about, I'd say, at least 30 people here right now from outside of the tribes. So and there's going to be more. That's, other people are still on the road, part I know, but are heading here. We're going to go over to the site here pretty soon, so start a nonviolent and a nice peaceful ceremony, do some singing and, you know,
it sounds like kind of a reflective time, but I've heard in the past that some of the objections to the hall coming through your tribal lands circle around resources like fish and traditional food harvesting and impacts on those traditional resources that the tribes hold sacred. Can you talk about any of the people who are there who may be directly impacted, either fisher folk or people who keep the tribal food stocks? Can you describe any of those people who are joining in the ceremony tonight?
Yeah, the primary one right now is Carl Sampson. He's a Walla Walla chief. Where the actual megalode was down in Umatilla, that was originally where they lived down in the area and fished down in the area in his younger days. And so he's really familiar with that land. He's real close to that part of the land along the Columbia River there. And, we're concerned about any impact that this thing might have on any river, any stream, any bank, you know, any possible damage they could, you know, involve themselves in. You know, we're worried about our roads and the bridges and the safety of the other people out there. And plus, the ultimate goal they have of being in Alberta, you know, just, you know, I've seen a lot of pictures of what happened up there, the traditional lands and the sacred and spiritual properties up there, and it's just completely destroyed. People are just being pushed aside, you know, and the same thing is likely to happen to us at any time down here. It's just we're just on the edges all right now, but they're making us a big part of it by traveling through here, so... So we all stand together, you know, brothers and sisters. So what affects our people up there or even in Idaho, you know, then we're going to stand with them against all these issues and try to keep each other, our next generation, healthy. Because it's, you know, we're afraid it's going to become a corridor if they keep doing it. And, you know, plus there's always a possibility that running that thing off the highway someplace, and somebody getting hurt and, you know, dumping something there.
Right, Art. Well, I think earlier I may not have let you introduce yourself fully, so I'd like you to do that. And you also mentioned that there's a Walla Walla chief there. If you want to introduce yourself fully and your tribal affiliation and maybe any other tribes that you have represented there, just to maybe give a shout out to those communities and give people a sense of the solidarity that's joining together with you there tonight for this ceremony.
Okay, yeah, my name is Art McConville. I'm a Nez Perce Cayuse enrolled at Umatilla Reservation here. My parents are from, my mother's side is from the Wallowa Mountain area. We're from the my dad, Looking Glass people up in Idaho, Clearwater River. And we've had people stand beside us here from Warm Springs and from the Birch Paiute people and people from over in Yakima Valley. And, of course, the Nez Perces who made the first stand against the load up there, and they got them shut down. But there's Native people all over, not just reservations, but urban people, you know, and they represent a lot of different tribes. And I'm sure that they're being, you know, involved in all of this along the way, along that path, wherever it goes. And then they're going to be near Flathead Country, get up that way. That's the biggest one, and up north there. And then they get up and run. You know, there's a lot of different Natives and reservations up in that area, and so... They're going to run into a lot of people, I think, and I think the closer they get to Canada, they're going to run into more conflicts.
Well, Art, I think you've given us a good sense of the people joining you there tonight for this ceremony. We're about out of time, but I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us live on the radio and for bringing your voice to this issue. Thank you, Art.
Sure, you're very welcome.
All right. And I'll thank the others who are on the phone. If you can pass the phone off to Paul, and I will close by reminding our listeners that we've been talking to folks who've gathered in Pendleton to have a ceremony this evening and engage people about the issue of the tar sands megaloads, which are being hauled through the state of Oregon and up to Alberta's tar sands. Thank you for listening to KBOO News. Stay tuned. We'll have full coverage of this event and others on coming news broadcasts.
Hey, KBOO supporters, we just sent you a card, so watch your mailbox. It's an opportunity to give a little more assistance at this time of year to your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. Yep. Tax time, that means that your donation makes a difference, and it'll really make a difference for KBOO because you can help us qualify for Oregon Cultural Trust matching funds. You can get more information about this on our website at kboo.fm/year-end-gift-2013.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
2013, the year of the whistleblower. U.S. spy apparatus was exposed for all to see. Join me, Linda Olsen-Osterlund, on a deeper look Thursday, December 26th. My guest is Carl Massinio of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, the man responsible for the face of Edward Snowden appearing on buses throughout Washington, D.C. It's the Thank You, Edward Snowden campaign. We'll take a look back at 2013, the year of the whistleblower. That's Thursday, December 26th at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Oregon Council 75, representing over 25,000 Oregon public and private sector employees, families, and communities, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members since 1942. More information at www.